I'm joined by Alicia Bell, Organizing Manager at Free Press and one of the creators of Media 2070, a project that highlights the media's role in perpetuating anti-Black racism throughout American history and explores what reparations might look like in the context of journalism. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Nelly. It's great to be here.
Can you introduce yourself and your work at Free Press?
Like they said, my name is Alicia Bell. I'm the Media 2070 director here at Free Press. Free Press is a national news, media, technology advocacy organization built to really make sure that the public and the people in our communities are connected to the technology, media, journalism policies that impact our lives. And in that context, I direct our Media 2070 project, which is a project aimed at figuring out what we want media ecosystems to look like in 2070 and how we get there. And so we're envisioning and imagining what reparations looks like, because we know that that is part of the pathway to get to something equitable in 2070. And we're doing the work of building that out right now.
So what are some of the harms that Media 2070 seeks to address? And what exactly do you mean by media reparations?
Well, you know, I think some of the harms come up when we even thought about how we named this project, right? So the project name it's rooted in the year 2070 because in 1919, there were what people named the race riots in Chicago. And about 1921, there was a Chicago Commission on Race that came out saying that media and journalism and newsrooms were creating narratives that contributed and helped co-create racial injustice and racialized oppression for Black folks in Chicago. And then about 50 years later, the same conversation happened at a federal national level with the Kerner Commission. So in 1968, you see another commission release another report saying the same things, where they said that newsrooms and journalists do not treat Black communities as if we have jobs, as if we have children, as if we go to school, that media newsrooms really flatten us into being whatever they need us to be for the purpose of a story. And then 50 years later, you know, we have 2019, 2020, 21, where we're having the exact same conversations around media, around news, around journalism. We have journalists of color who are organizing and caucusing in newsrooms to figure out how they can have parity, equity in their newsrooms. We also see people, kind of just the public in general, pushing back against the way that media and newsrooms platform white supremacy and white supremacist. And so that for us, that's a part of the harm. The fact that the harms from newsrooms against Black people have been named by official commissions at a local and a federal level for the past 100 years, and that nothing significant has changed. I mean, you see the small changes, right? So in the Chicago Commission, they said you should use the word Negro instead of the slur that begins with an N. And that's certainly a change that's been made, but it's definitely not enough. So we're looking at those things and wanting to figure out how we break that cycle of exhaustion and monotony that is required that Black folks advocate for our lives and our stories for 100 years without change and without shift. But we're also looking at really concrete things, right? So we're looking that are different than that. Concrete things like the fact that so many newsrooms came out of a history and a lineage of newsrooms running slave ads and being facilitators of chattel slavery. So one of the things we see throughout the duration of chattel slavery is newsrooms who are playing the role of facilitator for people who are buying and selling slaves. They're also making money off of and building capital off of slave owners wanting to publish ads for escaped or runaway slaves. And we see those economies and those revenues build and transform into things like classified ads, or build and transform into other newsrooms that those people were able to create, or those newsrooms that built their revenue were then sold to other news companies and made a profit off of the sale. So we're also looking at that very core journalism in the United States and how it's so much rooted in the oppression and facilitation of Black oppression and Black death. So those are the things that we're looking at with this project. And in that, we're really looking at the core of reparation, right? Repair, reconciliation. I love the way that the United Nations talks about reparations. They talk about cessation. You have to stop the thing. That there has to be some sort of restitution and compensation. That there has to be some sort of acknowledgement and satisfaction. That there has to be, and that there has to be rehabilitation as well. And so when we're thinking about reparations, we're thinking about that full scope. We're thinking about what are the reparations that newsrooms owe to Black communities? What are the reparations owed at a federal policy level and a local policy level for Black journalists and Black newsrooms? What is the reparative culture that needs to be created in newsrooms? And then also, what does the philanthropic reparation look like?
The media in general is facing an existential crisis. You know, we've had almost 1,800 newspapers that have closed since 2004, according to the UNC School of Media and Journalism. And we've seen thousands of journalism jobs just disappearing. What challenges and opportunities does this kind of twin crisis present for achieving a more equitable media ecosystem?
Yeah, I want to shout out Andrea Hart, who is on the board of Scalawag magazine, but also one of the co-founders of a journalism lab called City Bureau, for her thought partnership and helping me realize that the economic models and the business models of journalism were never going to survive anyway. And we see that now. We see that crisis, we see the shuttering of newsrooms, but when a system is built on the exploitation of people and the oppression of people, and its business models, its structuring is built on those things, the values are built on those things, who has power to decide even what the values are built on those things, there's no way in a multiracial democracy or in the pursuit of multiracial democracy that those systems are going to survive and thrive and be sustainable. And so I think what we're seeing now is an inevitability, right? An inevitability that was created by systems that weren't sustainable in the first place. But what we know is that journalism and storytelling are so important. And so the opportunity that I see with this crisis, this shuttering, this transformation that's going on in journalism right now, is that we do have an opportunity to think about how we create sustainable journalism that lives into the future. How we transform people's legacies so that the stories that people tell about them in the future are different than the ones we're telling about journalists and racist institutions now and several years ago. And if we want if we believe that journalism is important, if we believe that democracy is important, if we believe that storytelling, news and information are important to the ways that communities create and co-create themselves, then we have to transform and we have to shift in order to be carried into the future. And so, you know, I think I am always heartened by the fact there's a woman in Charlotte, North Carolina, Dr. Ophelia Brown, who says, never waste a chaos. And I feel like that is so pertinent to where we are in journalism right now. It is a chaotic place. There is a lot going on. There's a lot of movement, a lot of experimentation, a lot of trying things out. But it's our duty not to waste that. And so I think that the openness, the open-mindedness that people see to kind of transformation, to trying new things is definitely an opportunity. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that so many people at various levels and in various places of journalism are really moving from a scarcity mindset because there has been so much loss of revenue and so much loss of institution. And so really moving against that scarcity that is sometimes real, sometimes perceived in different ways. Moving against that scarcity is one of the biggest challenges to accomplishing and making reparations real.
The history of the relationship between the media, anti-Black racism, as you describe, really long-standing, and we've known about these problems for a very long time. One thing that's different now is, you know, the role of social media, and we've seen how it really, you know, propagates misinformation and racist ideology, you know, most recently fomenting the insurrection at the Capitol. And I'm wondering, how does social media fit within this project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, you know, so much of what we see on social media is a mirror of the histories we see of print media and then television or audio media. And so when I think, for example, about all the conversations coming up about platforming and deplatforming of white supremacists and white supremacy in social media spaces. But there's a connection there to the history of radio journalism and broadcast journalism, where in Mississippi, there was a radio station several years ago that was running these white councils, these white supremacist councils, who were getting on there doing radio shows, and then the shows were being syndicated and shared across the United States. And it took folks like Medgar Evers and the NAACP to really advocate and push back against that to make that stop. But the way that those radio stations were platforming white supremacists is the same thing we see with social media. So in some ways, we know how to fight it. We know that there is a power to either platforming or deplatforming individuals and movements. We also see it in the ownership of social media companies. And I believe this, right? If there is a de facto apartheid going on in journalism, there is absolutely the same thing happening in social media. Social media companies are not owned by Black people and people of color. The people who have power in these companies, by and large, are not Black folks, Indigenous folks. And so I think reimagining what the future of social media can look like, where Black folks have more ownership and control over how our stories and our experiences and our lives are stewarded, is so key, whether it's in the context of social media or in the context of other kinds of journalism. There's also an interplay between social media and journalism, where social media is making money off of journalism and journalists seek social media as a way to kind of promote their journalism. And so it has to be the fact that reparations lives at the weaving and the interconnection of those spaces.
Since you launched this project in October, I'm wondering, you know, what has the reception been, and have you seen any kind of promising developments or positive steps taken by news organizations?
You know, the hardest thing about the response since October is that so many people were ready for this to be released like many yesterdays ago. And so when we released this essay and we launched this campaign and this project, there were so many people who were like, give me my marching orders, tell me what to do. I'm ready to make this real. I'm ready for it to be happening in my newsroom or at a policy level or at my foundation. And we were coming into this process and still are. We want to build relationship with partner organizations and partners across these various sectors that impact the future of media, so that we can co-create what reparations looks like and co-create what our vision is for the future of media and journalism ecosystems. And so there's been a little bit of pull between, okay, like we want folks to be taking action. We want folks to be involved, but we also want to move at the speed of trust and move at the speed of relationship, because we know that that's the only thing that's really sustainable. And so we've been trying to figure out kind of collaborations and partnerships and ways to meet that excitement and that energy, because it's been so heartening and so exciting. I think one of the other questions that comes up so often is, well, tell me what reparations looks like. What is the very hard and fast, the policy look like? What does it look like in a newsroom? What does it look like in a foundation? And those are the things that we also have to kind of push back against to say, we're co-creating that. We're not trying to be gatekeepers in this work, because we know that we're not the only folks who have been thinking about this. We're not the only people who have been doing work around this. I think that, and the exciting piece of this is that there are so many people and so many newsrooms who are in the place of acknowledgement, right? So just before we released the essay, there was a big LA Times piece that came out acknowledging the history of racism. And then so at the end of the year, we saw the Kansas City Star, who was releasing a piece kind of naming their history of racism. And we see that in a variety of newsrooms and institutions. And at the same time, are hearing from newsrooms and public radio stations that they want to apologize, but just aren't sure how and aren't sure what to do after they apologize. So we're also thinking about how we work with those folks to get them to the place of acknowledgement. Because for us, that I guess a really broad way that this process happens is that there has to be acknowledgement that there's a debt that's owed and that harm has happened. And from that acknowledgement, we can move into vision. And from vision, we can move into pathway. And then we make that pathway real. And then we figure out what's on the other side of that pathway. And so it's really exciting to see so many newsrooms and institutions that are at the place of acknowledgement, that are ready to be public with that acknowledgement, and ready to move on to whatever comes after that.
And to that point, what can people listening to this interview do? Are there any actions that they can take? How can they learn more?
So the best way to kind of stay abreast of what's going on with this work is to go to media2070.org. That is where that's where the essay lives, but it's also where there are places to sign up, to stay connected, sign up if people want to partner. There is an email address, racialjustice@freepress.net. that folks can email if they're curious about what partnership could look like, about what collaboration could look like. So we really want folks to email us, to go on there and sign up. We're also actively fundraising for this project to build the financial capacity we need to do this organizing. So there's also opportunities for folks to invest in this work in that way. And then some of the actions, and I think this falls into some of the collaborations, is that the more newsrooms, the more institutions we have acknowledging their harm, the better foundation we have to move from. So if you are in a newsroom, or you are connected to a news organization or a media institution, that can take the step of acknowledging the harm that your newsroom has perpetuated historically, then we absolutely want to be working in collaboration with you and figuring out how to make that real. And from there, we can figure out what else it is that we need to build towards this vision of an ecosystem in 2070 that serves us all.
Thank you so much, Alicia. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.